dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And
this you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Venner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. This week, we begin the final chapter and penultimate reading from Charles Eisenstein's 2006 book, The Ascent of Humanity, The Age of Separation, The Age of Reunion, and The Convergence of Crises That's Birthing the Transition. Accompanying the reading this week will be several other voices that resonate with the ideas brought out in the reading. The stages of birth are a key metaphor that Eisenstein will employ in discussing the change of thinking and thence society from the ideology of domination and control to that of the age of reunion. And he will discuss the current phenomenon of those in society fighting to preserve the status quo as an attempt to forestall the process of birth by trying to crawl back into the womb, an impossibility. The G20 summit just concluded in Pittsburgh epitomizes such an attempt to preserve a system both literally and morally bankrupt. Other programs have reported on the repression that now routinely accompanies any challenge to the lords of capital. Swirling amid the public debate around the economic crisis, as it is called, are those asserting that our problems stem from various unconstitutional actions, as if the Constitution was a bulwark against concentrations of power. An examination of the history will show the Constitution in a far different light. So much of what we've been taught for so long is just not true. We'll begin with an examination of the question, was the Constitution an act of treason against the American Revolution? With Teresa Caraggio.
Our question this week is whether the U.S. Constitution was an act of treason. Treason is a deliberate act to subvert a government. But the Revolutionary War was fought in order to establish a government of, by, and for the people. Was this government by the people deliberately subverted by the so-called Founding Fathers? Did they find a way to co-opt the population into fighting their resource wars and working to multiply their wealth? We'll look at the Articles of Confederation, put into place after the Revolutionary War, which established a federal union of sovereign states, much like the European Union or the South African Union or the emerging UNASUR in Latin America. How did this differ from the Constitution that nullified it? Ironically, those who argued to preserve the federal government were dubbed the Anti-Federalist, led by Patrick Henry, who had earlier sparked the revolution with his statement, "Give me liberty or give me death." What did he and others warn against with the new government? I'd like to go back to 1787, when the New World was new, at least to Europeans. The Revolutionary War was over, and the Articles of Confederation were in place. Each state agreed to defend each other's sovereignty against any threat. All was not, however, calm on the Western Front. European investors in the war were demanding repayment in gold and silver. Wealthy urban businessmen were trying to squeeze whatever they could out of smallholders, many of whom had been conscripted into the war with no pay. Upon discharge, the states taxed them for the gold, then confiscated their land and houses, throwing them into debtors' prisons when unable to pay. Luke Day organized farmers and veterans to stop the foreclosures. The courts ordered the militia to intervene, but the militia were also often farmers and veterans. Boston elites were alarmed, and Samuel Adams drew up the Riot Act, suspending habeas corpus and proposing execution for rebellion. Washington wrote, "Commotions of this sort, like snowballs, gather strength as they roll if there is no opposition in the way to divide and crumble them." Daniel Shays joined Luke Day, and they shut down the local court. They petitioned the Massachusetts legislature to issue paper money to pay the veterans so they could pay their many taxes: class rates, town rates, province rates, and continental rates. Instead, Boston merchants, after failing to get other states to pay, funded a 4,000-man army to protect the Springfield court's debt collection and property seizures. In February of 87, they reached the armory ahead of Shays and put down the uprising. Then the merchant class got to work dividing and crumbling, so that in the future the populace would fund the army that served the moneyed interest against them. In May of 87, a convention was scheduled to meet to clarify the issuing of paper money and the regulation of trade. But a few men had a prior meeting in Annapolis with another idea: to use this convention to change the form of government from a union of sovereign states to a centralized supreme rule. John DeWitt, who wrote as Federal Farmer, describes it this way: "The states, still unsuspecting and not aware that they were passing the Rubicon, appointed members to the new convention for the sole and express purpose of revising and amending the Confederation. And probably not one man in 10,000 in the United States, till within these 10 or 12 days, had an idea that the old ship was to be destroyed, and he put to the alternative of embarking in the new ship presented, or of being left in danger of sinking." The delegates to this convention were principally connected to commerce, not members of Congress or judges. What they proposed wasn't an amendment to the Articles, but an entirely new form of consolidated government, with the power to tax directly, raise an army and navy, incur debts, and appoint judges that would rule over the state judiciaries. A New York judge named Robert Yates withdrew from the convention because it was overstepping its purpose. He became one of the most articulate and insightful anti-federalists, writing under the name of Brutus. He claimed that the Supreme Court would become a source of almost unlimited federal overreach, but his most dire predictions have been outstripped. Yates noted that portions of the proposed Constitution were well-formed, but that the gilded pill contains the most poison. He implored New Yorkers to look at the foundational pillars. One of these was that there be one representative for every 30,000 men, with five slaves counting for three free men. Yates writes passionately about the hypocrisy of a country founded on liberty practicing slavery, and shows this as a ruse to give slaveholders more power. A key point against state sovereignty has been our historical belief that slavery would have continued unimpeded without centralized rule. However, the new Constitution prohibited Congress from outlawing the import of slaves until 1808, although it could tax it. This 20-year reprieve on slavery indicates that there was a powerful movement to abolish it earlier. 1808 came and went without incident, showing that the new government, with disproportionate representation by slaveholders and funded by slave import taxes, was less motivated to abolish slavery than the original Confederacy had been. In 1833, Britain abolished slavery, so U.S. slaves would have been free if the U.S. had not split off. And still by the Civil War, 30 years later, Lincoln told Virginia that she could keep slavery if she didn't secede, once more proving that the reason wars are started and the reasons that justify them after the fact are two different things. We're talking about whether the Constitution and the underhanded way in which it was brought about constituted an act of treason against the government by, of, and for the people. We've seen that it wasn't introduced in Congress, but in a separate convention on trade and legal tender to which delegates were appointed. The expectation was that they would come to Congress with a proposed amendment to the Articles of Confederation. Instead, they introduced a new form of centralized government to replace the Federation of Sovereign States. Now we'll hear from Patrick Henry on his address to the convention. I rose yesterday to ask a question which arose in my own mind. The fate of America may depend on this. Have they said, we, the states? Have they made a proposal of a compact between states? If they had, this would be a confederation. It is otherwise most clearly a consolidated government. The question turns, sir, on that poor little thing, the expression, we, the people, instead of the states of America. Is this a monarchy, like England, a compact between prince and people, with checks on the former to secure the liberty of the latter? Is this a confederacy, like Holland, an association of a number of independent states, each of which retains its individual sovereignty? It is not a democracy, wherein the people retain all their rights securely. Had these principles been adhered to, we should not have been brought to this alarming transition from a confederacy to a consolidated government. Here is a resolution as radical as that which separated us from Great Britain. It is radical in this transition. Our rights and privileges are endangered, and the sovereignty of the states will be relinquished. The rights of conscience, trial by jury, liberty of the press, all your immunities and franchises, all pretensions to human rights and privileges are rendered insecure, if not lost, by this change. Is this tame relinquishment of rights worthy of free men? Is it worthy of that manly fortitude that ought to characterize Republicans? It is said 8 states have adopted this plan. I declare that if 12 states and a half had adopted it, I would, with manly firmness and in spite of an erring world, reject it. You are not to inquire how your trade may be increased, nor how you are to become a great and powerful people, but how your liberties can be secured, for liberty ought to be the direct end of your government. Patrick Henry continues on to say that Virginia should secede from the Union if this government is adopted. Switzerland, he points out, has lasted 400 years as a federation of different forms of government, which enabled it to withstand France and England. But the Constitution changing the government ended up being rushed through ratification with little time for the people to understand what it meant. The best that Henry was able to do was add the Bill of Rights, giving some teeth to a document that otherwise said in pretty language, "Here's what we all believe. Now trust us." The Founding Fathers, who drew up the Constitution, in fact represented early transatlantic corporations wanting trade monopolies, financiers wanting taxation and property repossession, and slavers wanting the institution to continue. Local democracies, like the United Farmers, Veterans, and Militia of Massachusetts, were their greatest enemy, to be divided and crumbled, according to Washington, or to be executed as traitors, according to Samuel Adams. Does a Congress made up of a Senate and House of Representatives double our power or divide and crumble it? How effective have we been against a centralized executive power that appoints the judiciary for life? I can't help but make comparisons to my research on whether the Bible is a false document. Like the Constitution, it represents itself as the voice of the people, the revolutionary peasant class. But in fact, I believe both were written by the elites as a trick to confuse and neuter the revolution by using its own language against it. My episode, Josephus and the Multicolored Turncoat, on RadioForAll.net goes into more detail.
That was Teresa Caraggio of Third Paradigm Radio in Santa Cruz. So now we begin Chapter 8. The final chapter, Self and Cosmos, from the Ascent of Humanity, the Age of Separation, the Age of Reunion, and the Convergence of Crises that's birthing the transition, by Charles Eisenstein. The Fall. I have portrayed separation from ourselves, from nature, and from each other as an engine of suffering and the cause of the multiple crises facing the planet. Because of this, and because separation has grown throughout history, and because it is in many important respects an illusion, many have conceived of it as an error, a blunder, or a sin, even the sin. Hence the age-old thread of returning to an earlier time, casting off the illusions of separateness, to return to the original unity. Yet elsewhere in this book, I have hinted of the inevitability of the age-old course of separation, the ways in which it builds upon itself, its inevitable progression implicit in pre-human and even prebiotic conditions. And intuitively, looking out on the fantastically complex structures of our society, one would like to ascribe to them a purpose, a cosmic reason, more than it was a mistake that should be erased. Yes, the ascent of our self-definition as discrete and separate beings has brought endless destruction, atrocities, and alienation. But it has also brought us to unsuspected points of view, modes of creative expression, and forms of beauty. The wasteland of modern society, its endless strip malls and ravaged ecosystems and dying languages and suicidal youth and empty consumption and lonely people, is it all for naught? If separation is the root of all evil, then to ask the purpose of separation brings us to the old theological conundrum of the purpose of evil. Why, the theologians ask, did God allow suffering in the world? True, it was Adam and Eve who chose separation from God through eating the fruit of the knowledge of good and evil. But it was God who presented them with that choice in the first place, and who must have foreseen what the choice would be. Why, for that matter, did God create the devil? Why did God create anything at all? Why not remain the all and everything? We can pose the same question in other religions. In Taoism, why did the undifferentiated Hundun, the original formlessness, differentiate into yin and yang, and then the 10,000 things? In Buddhism, why did the non-dualistic original mind partition itself to create the illusion of self and other? Through a mythological investigation of these questions, perhaps we can also answer the question in its modern form. What is the ultimate purpose of the descent of humanity from a place of enchantment, understanding, and wholeness to the separation, alienation, and ruin of the present day? In the theistic regions of the archetypal story of separation, prior even to the Garden of Eden, is the myth of Lucifer's fall from heaven. This was the original separation, the template and essence of all the separation that was to come. The devil is normally viewed as the epitome of all evil, an identity that makes sense when we understand separation, the illusion of the discrete and separate self, as the source of our present crisis. Significantly, the devil as Lucifer is associated with light, that is, with fire, and therefore with the original technology that defined the circle of domesticity I described in an earlier chapter. The same function appears in Greek mythology in the figure of Prometheus, whom the gods punished for giving humans the power to be like them, to become, through the technologies of fire, the lords and possessors of nature, usurping what was once a divine function. The foresight of the Greek mythmakers was truly amazing. How could they have known how close we would come to achieving for ourselves the Olympian powers of flight, rulership over natural processes, and maybe even eternal youth and immortality? Just as in Judeo-Christian tradition, the role of firebringer is combined with that of God's enemy. The Greeks, too, understood the doom implicit in the power of fire, the doom that we are experiencing today. Quote, Prometheus, you are glad that you have outwitted me and stolen fire. But I will give men as a price for fire an evil thing, in which they may all be glad of heart while they embrace their own destruction." Close quote. That evil thing was Pandora's box, appearing like a drug, like a technological fix, so desirable but filled with strife, disease, and ruin that we have known since the first technology. Lucifer's fall represents the very beginnings of separation from God, just as the technology of fire was humanity's first abrogation and arrogation of nature's cycle of energy flow, marking the beginning of our separation from nature. Then, in the figure of Satan, we have the further legend of the devil at war with heaven, or trying to set himself above God, a theme echoed in the Babel story, the tree of knowledge of good and evil, and countless other myths. This represents our campaign to become the lords and masters of nature. It is the domestication of the wild, the technological program, the world under control. Just as in myth, the war against heaven is ultimately doomed, and the pain endured in this losing campaign is proportional to the intensity with which it is waged. The failure of the technological fix, the failure of the program to bring all the world under control, we address by intensifying the effort to control, sacrificing more and more of life to war. And so in the modern era, we have sold away our very lives to the enslavement of time and money. However, we may take solace in the further observation that the war against heaven is itself not outside the divine plan, but part of it. In parallel, the ascent of humanity, the ascent of technology and separation, is not a wrong turn or a blunder, but a necessary part of a process. In fact, to believe in a purposeless wrong turn is to reinforce the very assumptions that gave it rise. It is to believe ourselves an exception to the rule of nature described in Chapter 6. No trait evolves accidentally, but only in fulfillment of an environmental purpose. Our separation from nature, our war against nature, our ambition to transcend nature forever is actually in accord with nature's purpose, an evolutionary step not just of the human species, but of the planet as a whole. Our apparent separation is actually a step toward wholeness at a higher level of complexity, a stage in the extension of nature to a new realm. A mythological narrative can help illustrate this process. Once upon a time, there was unity, God, but no creation. In Taoism, the undifferentiated Hundun, the original formlessness. In Buddhism, the non-dualistic original mind. Then, after an eternal interval, this unity decided to experience separation from itself. In other words, God split God's self into trillions of little pieces, which gradually forgot who they were. The reason was to experience what that is like, and eventually to come back together again at a higher level of consciousness. We could even see Lucifer as the first heroic volunteer. "Who shall go?" a voice thundered to itself. And finally, part of that voice split off, separated, and therefore descended into hell, presaging the deepening hell we find ourselves in when we maintain and widen our separation from nature, other people, and the divine. The mounting crises of the world are none other than this. Perhaps separation is not an evil, but rather an adventure of self-discovery. Perhaps technology is an exploration of the illusion of separateness, that the whole may come to better know itself, achieving reunion, yes, but at a higher level than before. In other words, there is a purpose to the fall, and thus a purpose to the whole course of separation that is reaching its apogee at the present time. For this purpose to be fulfilled, it is necessary that separation run its full course, to the very extreme we are experiencing today. For what is the ultimate degree of separation except to have forgotten one's divine nature so completely as to disbelieve in divinity itself, that is, to disbelieve in any order, purpose, or destiny other than that which we impose upon reality? The clockwork universe that underlies our present worldview represents the furthest reaches of separation. It is a world in which there is not and could not logically be any meaning or purpose or divinity. Today we are exploring these far reaches of hell, a situation that Rudolf Steiner foresaw as the war of all against all. How like the neo-Darwinian selfish gene theory of life, that is. The present era exploration of the furthest reaches of separation is therefore a cosmic necessity that must and will play out to its final resolution. Despite the near unanimous recognition by scientists that we are rapidly destroying the basis of human life on Earth, the destruction proceeds apace as if we were helpless to stop it. And helpless we are. Certainly, there are isolated victories. Roads halted, incinerators closed, forests saved, dams removed. But the overall trend is toward worsening degradation of the environment. The same applies to various social, political, and medical trends. It is as if some collective will were pushing us toward the full experience of hell. It is as if we must, like the drug addict, hit bottom and render transparently hopeless a campaign to manage life, to control reality. Only then will we surrender to the, quote, higher power, which is nothing other than nature herself. The uncontrolled, the wild, and the war against heaven will be over. No longer holding ourselves away from heaven, we will be drawn back into it with hardly an effort. The necessity of exploring the furthest reaches of separation means that none of the long history of separation was an error. Even the scientific revolution of Galileo, Newton, Descartes, and the rest, which launched the current most extreme alienation of ourselves from the universe, was a necessity. We had to go through it. It was implicit in everything that came before it. The only error would be to fail to learn from that experience. On an individual level, too, each breakthrough in our spiritual evolution is preceded by a separation, a dark night of the soul, which can be so thorough as to parallel the Newtonian world machine in denying not only the existence, but the very relevance and possibility of God. When we come back to our true selves, back into union, it is with greater experience and wisdom. It is almost inevitable that most of us will experience in this lifetime a crisis of faith, which may or may not be explicitly religious in character. It makes little difference what religion we are brought up in, because the crisis will find and obliterate whatever order, purpose, or meaning we assign to the universe, so that we may be reborn into a new understanding of purpose that contains and supersedes the old. Even if we return to the religion of our childhood, it is at a wholly new level of understanding. So successful are we at holding the crisis of faith in abeyance that it often doesn't strike until old age, when death's imminence renders long-held delusions transparent. Those who have grown up in a religion or non-religion and never fully questioned its deepest foundations have as little reason for complacency as a pre-industrial society that has yet to experience industrialism's dislocations, not because they have been transcended, but simply because they have not yet arrived. The experience has a developmental necessity. Again, the only mistake is not to learn from it, not to integrate it, but to hold the attitudes and beliefs that generated it in the first place. Whether to cooperate with our birthing into a new concept of who we are, or to fight this process to the last extreme, is up to each of us. Let us hope we do not wait until the last extreme, the utter ruin of life and world. Let ugliness and wrongness become intolerable before then. Anything you do to spread the knowledge that life is meant to be beautiful and meaningful Anything you do to convince people not to settle for less will lower our tolerance for ruination and raise the bottom from which our addicted society will renew. I think the best way to spread this message is for us not to settle for less ourselves. I have often been inspired by those who, as Gandhi enjoined, refuse to participate in anything humiliating, or who dedicate their lives to creating beautiful things, or who are deeply attuned to plants and animals, or who live free of the mentality of what they can afford to do, or who bring people together through the force of their love, who are generous without effort or stint, who see right through me and love me anyway, knowing I am good. These people show us our birthright, what life is meant to be. Seeing their joy, passion, love, generosity, and creativity, we no longer will tolerate a system and an ideology that creates the opposite. Life can be better than this. And I'm reading from The Ascent of Humanity by Charles Eisenstein. The Perinatal Matrix. The tides of separation and reunion repeat on all levels, individual and collective, and in many dimensions of life, taking us back again and again to wholeness, not as a circling back, but as a spiraling, each reunion at a higher level of wisdom, consciousness, complexity, and integration. The last section described the mythological template for this process, but perhaps the most intuitive model for the dynamics of separation and reunion is the process of birth. In the same way we are born physically as individuals, so we are being born collectively by our Mother Earth and spiritually into a new concept of who we are. Stanislav Grof has developed a powerful and detailed model of the psychodynamics of birth, which he divides into four perinatal stages: uterine bliss, confinement, struggle, and emergence into the light. Since birth is the archetype of the process of separation and individuation, it is useful to apply Grof's model metaphorically to our present condition. The first stage of the birth process covers the months before the fetus has begun to push up against the limits of the uterus. She lives in a warm, rhythmic, rocking environment where her needs are automatically met effortlessly. All she does is exist and grow, physically and mentally. The psychological state corresponding to stage one is one of complete security, complacency, and a feeling of no limits. The world offers endless room for growth. In the mythic realm, stage one is represented by the Garden of Eden, where every need is effortlessly met, and in the golden age of ancient legend, where people still lived in the bosom of nature and knew not struggle and strife. Quote, "The earth herself without compulsion, untouched by hoe or plowshare, of herself gave all things needful," close quote. In terms of humanity in the earth, stage one was the hunter-gatherer stage. Although life had its occasional tragedies and pain, just as the fetus is sometimes subject to disturbances in the womb, the overall environment was bounteous and nurturing. We were few and the world large. We had not yet begun to test the limits of the environment or to see the world as limited. This attitude, that there is unlimited room to grow, can be found in the biblical injunction, "Be fruitful and multiply." Out of habit and inertia, this attitude is still with us, even though it is driving us toward catastrophe. As a natural consequence of growth, the uterus eventually becomes confining. The fetus loses her freedom of movement as a once blissful universe turns against her. Because the cervix is still closed, there is literally no way out of this increasingly uncomfortable predicament. When the contractions start, universal, all-encompassing pressure bears down on the fetus from every direction. Stage two thus corresponds to the psychological states of despair, depression, and hopelessness. In stage two, the Eden of the uterus has become a hell. Just as there is no way out for the fetus, hell is a place beyond hope of redemption. The basic condition of the universe is of hopeless suffering. In the language of mystics, this is a state known as the dark night of the soul, the feeling of utter abandonment by God. Spirituality seems a cruel joke, faith a delusion. It is the cardboard world. Its meaninglessness is transparent. Existentialism is closely linked to stage two of the birth process, in which there is literally no exit. We are just machines made from meat, and nothing matters, and nothing could ever matter. For several millennia now, the human race has been immersed in the ever-deepening misery of stage two. One by one, we have bumped up against the physical and social limits of growth. No longer can we continue to grow as we have for the last 10,000 years. No longer can we continue to expropriate more and more of the environment. Our problem-solving efforts only generate more problems because they are based on extending our control over the environment, bringing more and more of it into the human realm. They are an attempt at continued growth within the same womb. Any solution which boils down to, let's bring more of the universe under human direction, will inevitably exacerbate our condition, bringing us closer to the limits of what the environment can provide. We cannot use the master's tools to dismantle the master's house. At the end of stage two, the direction of transformation can no longer be a continuation of the growth in the womb, but must rather become a journey into a new world. The last century, encompassing two world wars, genocide after genocide, and the accelerating deterioration of the living planet, has finally rendered utterly transparent the illusion that control over nature and its apotheosis in the machine could ever fulfill its utopian promise. It laid bare the bankruptcy of our solutions, and hence our helplessness to improve what we, seeing no alternatives, call the human condition. We were stuck, trapped. The machines our servants had enslaved us, the womb turned poisonous, and we thought it just to be the nature of things, so unable were we to conceive an alternative technology or a kind of growth that was not more taking. Meanwhile, our scientific technology exacerbated those feelings of hopelessness, meaninglessness, and abandonment by putting us in a mechanistic, spiritless universe of impersonal forces and generic masses. We were left alone in a dead, pitiless universe, doomed by nature and human nature to struggle pointlessly for survival in a world rendered ever more horrible by our efforts. Although we might try to soldier on, the once bountiful world womb can no longer sustain the growth of fetal humanity. The effort to squeeze just a few more years out of what remains of the mother's resources, natural, social, cultural, and spiritual capital, will only poison the womb still further. Yet the exhaustion of these resources for growth does not alter our fetal civilization's built-in imperative to grow. Hence the inevitability of its demise or its transformation. It's very simple. A fetus grows. The womb is finite. The limits of growth trigger a birth crisis. Unbearable though it is, stage two is a necessary part of any birth process. If the status quo did not become intolerable, there would be nothing to impel change, birth into a new state of being, and we would turn away uncomprehending from the light when it finally presented itself. That is what happens in stage three. A way out is finally glimpsed. This way out is not some technological fix that makes the womb inhabitable just a little longer, much less a technotopian fantasy in which the womb magically becomes infinitely large. That would be a recipe for stagnation and stillbirth. In stage three, the enormous pressures on the fetus are revealed to have a purpose, a direction as the cervix opens and a light shines through, promising a new world. The physical distress of the fetus is even greater now than it was in stage two. She is subject to titanic pressures that slowly propel her through the birth canal. a life and death struggle occupying the whole of her being. At this point, there is no going back to the womb of the familiar, for that womb is a hell now, and besides, the pressures of birth are too great to resist. While physically more difficult, psychologically, a stage 3 state is easier to bear, for the light ahead gives hope and direction. For the human species, it represents our growing knowledge that another way of living is possible. We can see a glimpse of it already, the light at the end of the tunnel, the new modes of technology, money, medicine, education, and so forth I have described. At this point, it may seem that we are resisting the birth process, trying to climb back into the womb, maintaining the delusion of endless linear growth even as it crushes us. This is not unusual in a stage 3 dynamic. Say we enter a new job or relationship, grow within it, then eventually bump against its limits. The job or relationship becomes increasingly intolerable, but we bear with it, seeing no alternative and hardly daring to believe that the good womb has reached a limit. Then a new possibility presents itself, a new career, a new or transformed relationship, but we may shy away from it in fear, preferring the womb of the familiar even as it grows increasingly intolerable. We crawl back in, but the next contraction is even stronger. Some people go back and forth until their status quo becomes truly intolerable. The early contractions are the gentlest. The first might be a glimpse of an opportunity. Eventually, the womb of the old situation becomes a living hell, and it is impossible to go back. Forces beyond our conscious control take over, and we are born into a new world. Collectively, we humans have experienced only the beginnings of the birth pangs that will propel us into the new world we have glimpsed. We are still able to resist, still able to deceive ourselves into thinking that we can expropriate from nature endlessly, that nature has infinite wealth for our taking and infinite capacity for our waste. This illusion is disintegrating rapidly, and the disintegration will accelerate dramatically in our lifetimes. The crisis rapidly converging on our species are nothing less than the uterine contractions that will propel us into a new way of being. We humans have been moving out of stage 2 into stage 3 for nearly a century now. In some areas, this transition is more advanced than others. For example, while it is true that we are destroying the environment at an accelerating pace, no longer do we ignore it or unquestioningly assume it is part of the inescapable order of things. On a general level, we know what the problem is and we know what we must do about it. To actually implement that knowledge is the archetypal stage 3 struggle. Solutions such as full cost accounting, zero waste manufacturing, community currencies, renewable energy, holistic medicine, and so forth are known. Many forces are in denial, but the general solutions are known to us. To many fighting for these causes, the situation looks hopeless. What will spur us to actually implement these necessary solutions? Mother Nature and Mother Culture are having terrible birth pangs now. The contractions take the form of natural disasters, economic crises, famines, epidemics, and soon, environmental catastrophe. It is likely that we will keep trying to return to the womb of unlimited growth until our limits become starkly obvious. It may indeed take a wholesale environmental collapse before we change ourselves. On the mythological level, stage 3 corresponds to religious archetypes of Armageddon, the final battle between good and evil, or Ragnarok, the battle between the gods and giants in Norse mythology. At Ragnarok, all the worthy warriors who died in battle fight on the side of the gods. This myth refers to the common struggle that we all experience. It means that our personal battles have universal significance. The collective transformation of our species can only be the sum of billions of individual transformations, each driven by the intersection of generalized crises with our individual lives. No longer will we be able to hide from them. No longer will they be something that happens somewhere else to someone else. In one form or another, they will affect us all personally. Because we are not discrete individuals, but exist in relationship to the rest of humanity and the rest of nature, it is impossible to enjoy lasting health amidst an ailing society and a poisoned planet. It is impossible. It is a contradiction in terms. In stage 4 of birth, the baby is born into a new and unimagined world where he becomes an anatomically distinct individual. In any kind of birth process, the entity being born cannot imagine what lies beyond the mother's body. In the case of humanity as well, the new society we are being born into is probably beyond imagining. I expect my halting attempts to describe an age of reunion fall woefully short of its true magnificence. Whatever form collective humanity and individual life will take, one thing is certain. It will not be a final triumph or mastery over nature. We will be no more independent of nature than an infant, having outgrown the umbilical connection, is independent of her mother. Birth is a journey that starts with blissful oneness, proceeds through an increasingly unbearable confinement, climaxes in a heroic struggle, and ends with a return to the one, but at a new level of being. In human birth, this is the breast, the reuniting with the mother in a new, more highly individuated way. Once upon a time, we were enwombed in nature, without the possibility of even an illusory separation. In the age of reunion that will follow the present birthing, we will gaze upon Mother Nature's face with the adoring eyes of an infant. Archaeologists and historians are fond of infantile metaphors to describe prehistoric or ancient society, the cradle of civilization. Perhaps these metaphors are misleading. Even now, humanity is not yet in its infancy. An incredible journey awaits us. We humans and even the planet itself are undergoing a birthing. To what state we can only speculate. We have passed through the long gestation of the hunter-gatherer. We have grown up against the limits of our environment until we could grow no more, and now the labor is beginning that will likely stretch our capacities to the limit. Some environmentalists, especially those with the most comprehensive knowledge, despair that it is already too late to save our planet. Irreversible processes already in motion to assure our destruction. But perhaps these conditions are what it will take to turn the long-gathering capabilities of science and technology to their true purpose, the restoration and furtherance of nature's patterns, and the creation of new forms of beauty. Perhaps the impending catastrophe will demand that every facet of our civilization's scientific and technological achievement be turned toward the planet's healing, galvanizing humankind, and drawing us together in a way similar to, but far more powerful than, the space race of the 1960s and the last century's wars against cancer, poverty, drugs, and each other ever have. Perhaps nothing less than an all-out struggle will secure the survival of our species. Perhaps only in such a struggle can we rise to our potential and our purpose. In healing the ruination of nature, goodness, beauty, and life, we will transcend who we were and be born into something else. You've been listening to a reading from The Ascent of Humanity, The Age of Separation, The Age of Reunion, and the Convergence of Crises That's Birthing the Transition, published by Charles Eisenstein in 2006. Next week at long last, the conclusion of the book. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse. 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. The age of reunion is not some far-off or incomprehensible thing. The people of reunion are already among us. Here are some of their voices.
My name is Abby Young, and I live in Santa Cruz, California. We live in a small house on a big lot near a county park. It has a backyard that had become a big rectangle of hard-baked clay and crabgrass over the years. I had tried to dig and scrape the weeds away to grow a small garden, but with very modest success, and eventually it became too much for me, so for the last few years, I just weeded and then wistfully covered the earth with cardboard to keep the crabgrass at bay, and left it at that. In 2007, I met David Evershed, a student who was finishing his last year at UCSC in Environmental Studies. He came over to help me one Sunday with a few small garden projects that I still could manage. We kept in touch after that, and a year later, David called to say he was now in the UCSC Farm Apprenticeship Program. This is a program that's known all over the world for its training in intensive organic farming and sustainable agriculture. And remarkably, it has operated for over 40 years with more than 1,200 apprentices who have graduated. So from April to October every year, 30 to 40 new apprentices manage and operate the 2-acre Alan Chadwick Garden and the 25-acre farm on the UCSC campus, learning methods of organic farming. And for these 6 months, most of them are living outdoors on the farm in a community of tents. So this was what David was doing. He told me that one of his fellow apprentices, Brian Coltrane, had a great idea and that my yard would be perfect for it. Brian had developed a project he called the Grow Food Party, where a group of volunteers gather to help someone dig a garden and plant food. Just like that. Just because. And so far, he had planted 15 urban gardens this way. Now, because David had told him about my barren backyard, Brian was offering to gather a group of apprentices to do a similar project. At first, I was a little unclear on the concept. What would these people get from coming over on their day off, Sunday, to dig and plant in my forlorn backyard? No problem, said Brian when I talked to him. This was just a way they could pass on their care for the community and their hopes for the planet. Well, I was still uncertain about it and what was in it for them, but I agreed on the condition that I could make an audio tape for them to document the day. So we had a plan. On Sunday morning, June 29, 8 apprentices from the farm arrived at my door with their personal shovels. They had all volunteered from a handwritten poster that Brian had put up on the farm that week that said, "Imagine a world where food is growing everywhere and everyone is tending the land and sharing the harvest." Join me now to hear the story of these wonderful people and the Grow Food Party crew. I'd love hearing about each of you and what you're doing and how you're, how you got into the program. I know this isn't exactly digging, but it's important.
I'm Dan DeRosa. I've just always been into life and the earth in general, and I'd like to give something back, and it's something I'm into, and I don't know how I came to be here. I had a friend who went through the program and talked to me about it, and I was growing some food up in the mountains, and I'd done some wolfing abroad, which is volunteering on organic farms.
And
after this program, I'm not exactly sure. I'm thinking about starting an organic farm in San Diego, or urban farm, yes. And I feel as though San Diego really needs that. There's not too much of it in my experience. They sort of need some foodies down there. And the farmers markets are sort of locked up, so if we could start an alternative for, you know, smaller growers, I think it'd be good. I may be moving to Australia as well. I have an opportunity to work on an organic farm there through some friends. I don't know. I'm sort of, it's a progression.
Yeah, really? Well,
avocados and macadamia.
Oh.
Yeah.
And I just did a lot of internships. And
this is David Evershed.
Oh, yeah. My name's David Evershed.
David Evershed.
and the bummer about doing internships is that, like, I would get to work with the apprentices, and, like, it would be so fun. But, like, just as we were getting to the heart of things, you know, I'd have to, like, go off and go to class and, like, sit in class and try and learn, you know. I quickly realized that that's not what I wanted to do. So I graduated early and applied to the program and got in. And here I am. Luckily and thankfully.
Fantastic.
And afterwards, my family has some property in Wyoming. It's like right on a river and just beautiful, beautiful area. And so I'm going to go start farming there.
Great.
Exactly.
How about you? My name's Molly Culver. I am from Connecticut originally. And I was living in New York for about 8 years, doing urban farming, urban gardening, and community gardens there.
In, like, the city?
Mm-hmm, in the Bronx, yeah. Right in the middle of public housing, right in, you know, the poorest neighborhood in the Bronx, essentially. But luckily, because of what was missing there, people started building gardens in the 70s, so there's still community gardens there that grow food. And so I was working with kids and gardeners there and running a farmer's market. And we had a CSA as well that connected people to farmers outside the city. So that is where I'm coming from. And I'm not sure where I'm going next, but I think farming is definitely in my future. I definitely want to farm, so it's going to be either another farm to learn some other kind of skill, or, you know, working with animals or something like that.
And something I'm interested in from all of you is, it's not farming as in agribiz anymore. You're trying to recreate something about farming that is important. Do you have any thoughts on that? I'm interested in what it is you're trying to recreate, because it's, you're not going to be growing
corn, 50 acres of corn, or 6 million acres of corn.
50 acres of corn. Yeah. So, but this urban idea, or how it heals communities, too, there's something about that.
It definitely builds community, I think. Yeah, I watched a lot of relationships build in that garden, that, you know, between neighbors that didn't know each other at all before being involved, and, like, before being CSA members, and, yeah.
Okay, let's hear what Brian has to say. Yeah, a picture over there.
Okay. Here's the stuff we're gonna do.
By and large,
there's really two sections. This is the veggie beds right here. It's the garden part right there. This is what I'm trying to work on, this keyhole design. So I think what we'll do is, you know, we'll stick out a spot for them. We'll see what looks good, and then we have flower right here. We can just lay it out what looks like the right spot. So we could get to double dig. Great news. I think what we'll do is we double dig the spot for this. We'll do the forking, and then it's going to be modified double digging, because we'll throw out the dirt to the side of the path, and then as you throw it back in, we'll just mix it in with this compost stuff that we got, this, like, topsoil mix, basically. I'll talk to
which
you
is in the back in the carport. We have two truckloads.
Then we may, and then we need to mulch paths, and then we have irrigation stuff. I haven't been on irrigation yet, so if anyone who has is familiar with
that.
No, you have been?
I've laid irrigation.
So we can lay the header for sure, which we have, and we can know, like, the spots where it will come up out of there, but as long as we have this, the header laid, then I think we can, that'll be good. If anyone wants to volunteer for that, Then this keyhole garden is just the part that's further up right here, the thing you come into first, you know? It's like right where that mulch pile is. And that's going to be some modified design of, you know, like a rounded kind of keyhole, like a thing that comes in. We'll dry it up. So then we'll lay that out with the flower, and then we're going to add soil to that. Dig it, and then we're gonna make these like kind of modified gopher boxes that we sink in there. Then we have about 4 trees to plant. See Abby on their placement.
Yeah.
We're gonna
try. We have an apple, a plum, and a Chinese elm to replace the liquid amber that we took out. Who's remaining right there?
Okay.